watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this we go riding.
In the name of the flounder and of the sunfish and of the holy mackerel, bless this mess, this U.S., this not us. Before us the tree of liberty stands, and there is one rotten branch. So, like good stewards of the land, we must sever it, lest it infect the entire tree or the entire forest. We must gingerly take it down using old tools, at hand or borrowed. And then what? We must buck it up, piece by piece, and judge each fragment by its ability to keep us warm on cold winter nights. We may even have to burn some of them, because we in Vermont have an obligation and a tradition to participate in world politics at a level that stands correctly opposed to the method and the means of the current use of force in the United States. If we do not do this, we are asleep. And so we come to this point where we must get beyond the theoretical and start the actual. And I can't restrain myself, but I must present some ideas for your consideration. It's time to get down to the real business of town meetings, which is this. If your town votes to ban genetically engineered crops, then your town should also be prepared to enforce such a ban. And while my colleague Ethan Allen may be in favor of militias, I am advocating for a cultural weapon. A cultural weapon so powerful, so mobile that it can explode at any moment with countless successive percussions. Lock and load these four chambers of the heart. One, poetry. All the arts are included as a study in communication and an application of voices, loud and quiet. Two, diversity. Tolerance and understanding for all genders, ages, sexualities, races, and religious preferences. Three, home. By this we mean Vermont. We mean the spaceship Earth, as well as the homes in your neighborhood. May they stand in harmony with nature and each other. And number four, mystery, meaning faith, the empty chamber that needs no explanation, the vast unknown which is open before us. In the name of the flounder and of the sunfish and of the holy mackerel.
That was puppeteer Reverend Ben T. Matchstick, delivering the invocation last Friday at the first statewide convention to discuss the secession of the state of Vermont from the United States. The convention was put on by the Second Vermont Republic, an organization founded by Thomas Naylor and others interested in decentralization and political downsizing as a means to realize the self-rule promised but not delivered by the American system. This week and next on the program, we'll bring you some of the presentations and discussions. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, or WRFN Nashville. The first statewide convention on Vermont secession was attended by a couple of hundred people and was a follow-up to a smaller meeting held last year. This is one of the times I wish I was a video maker so you could see the backdrop of the proceedings you are about to hear. The sessions were held in the General Assembly Chamber of the Vermont State House in Montpelier. Our listeners on WGDR in Plainfield, Vermont, probably need no explanation. But for the rest of us elsewhere, in Vermont, citizens can apply for permission to hold events in the State House when the legislature is not meeting. The Vermont State House has been lovingly maintained in its 19th century grandeur. The Renaissance-style marble, red velvet upholstery, gold-leafed ornament, and heavy carved furniture lent a gravitas to the proceedings. Yet it was welcoming in a way that I have never before encountered in a so-called public building, where the public is normally made to feel like intruders. After you climb the broad marble stairs and push open the carved wooden double doors, you just walk in. No armed, uniformed men demand your papers or X-ray your belongings. It makes you feel like a citizen instead of a slave. The conference, of course, was focused on Vermont, but as Naylor has suggested elsewhere, Vermont might lead the way by providing an independent role model for other states or regions to follow. The organization is called the Second Vermont Republic because, from 1777 to 1791, Vermont was an independent republic which voted to join the United States and become the 14th state. This action by the Vermont legislature, if legally done, could legally also be undone, Naylor says. We'll begin as Thomas Naylor of the Second Vermont Republic gives a brief introduction to the motivation for secession.
The question of why secession is the issue I would like to spend a couple of minutes on. We're not assuming that everyone at this convention is a secessionist. Some of the speakers who were invited are very much opposed to secession. But nevertheless, this is a conference on secession, and it might be useful to spell out the rationale underlying the question, why in the world would Vermont or any state ever want to secede? Fundamental to the reason for secession seems to me is really two problems with the United States government. It's essentially lost its moral authority. Our government has no soul. It's become unsustainable, ungovernable, and unfixable. Conservatives like to rail against the federal government. They suggest that the federal government is the source of all evil. Liberals or Vermont progressives, on the other hand, aim their attacks against corporate America. The Second Vermont Republic thinks they're both right, that they're really twin enemies of Vermont. One is called the U.S. government. The other one is called corporate America. Corporate America owns, operates, and controls the United States government. The U.S. government has become too big, too centralized, too powerful, too intrusive, too materialistic, and too unresponsive to the needs of ordinary citizens and small communities. Essentially, what we've managed to do is emulate many of the aspects of our old nemesis, the Soviet Union, who we used to ridicule because it pretended to have a multi-party political system when, in fact, everybody knew there was only one game in town. But we believe the United States has evolved into the same direction, that essentially what we have in the United States is a single political party, the Republican Party, disguised as a two-party system. The Democratic Party is effectively brain dead. It hasn't had an original idea since the 1960s. It really doesn't matter in the next election whether Hillary Clinton or Condoleezza Rice is the next president. The results will be equally grim. Some other members of the Second Vermont Republic are disillusioned by the so-called American way, corporate greed, the war on terrorism, homeland security, denial of civil liberties, pandering to the rich and powerful, environmental insensitivity, pseudo-religious drivel, prisoner abuse, and an overall kind of culture of deceit. In terms of the loss of moral authority, I was specifically referring to a foreign policy. We have a foreign policy that didn't start with President Bush, it goes back many years, that's essentially based on the concept of full spectrum dominance, which means that we have the right to invade any country that we so to desire, and then that disagrees with us and ask questions later. We have a military presence in over 150 countries while simultaneously engaging in two wars, and it seems highly likely that will be engaged in more wars in just a short period of time. So those are some of the reasons why we think it makes sense to consider secession. At the end of the day, we're going to propose for your consideration two resolutions in the final session. The two resolutions. The first resolution, not surprisingly, is a Vermont independence resolution. Be it resolved that the state of Vermont peacefully and democratically free itself from the United States of America and return to its status as an independent republic as it was between January 15, 1777 and March 4, 1791. The second resolution is entitled the UNPO resolution, and I'll explain in more detail in the final session what the UNPO is, but you'll get the gist of it. Whereas the United Nations, I'm sorry, the Unrepresented Nations and Peoples Organization, UNPO, an international membership organization located in The Hague, is dedicated to nonviolence, human rights, self-determination, and democracy, environmental protection, and tolerance. Be it resolved that the Second Vermont Republic apply for membership in the UNPO as soon as possible.
Thomas Naylor, Professor Emeritus of Economics at Duke University and founder of the Second Vermont Republic.
The next speaker is actually my favorite Vermonter. He doesn't know that, but it's true, who had a lot of influence on my decision to move to Vermont in 1993. As a kind of follow-on to the book that he and John McClory wrote, The Vermont Papers, which is an absolute classic that everyone should read, he published a little piece in the Utney Reader comparing life in Vermont with life in Switzerland. And I read that and said, aha, that's it, and was able to con my wife into moving here. Another way to describe Frank Brown is that since Solzhenitsyn left the state 10 years ago, Brown is hands down the most interesting person living in the state of Vermont, I mean, just for starters. He's been identified with secession in this state since it's kind of alluded to, it's hinted to in the Vermont Papers in like 1988 or something like that. I mean, Then he and Bill Mayers, who was in the state legislature in the House in those days, they rewrote the Vermont Secession Guide. Some think tongue in cheek. It's again. I mean, he and Ethan Allen. This kind of mystery. Who is the real Frank Brown? What does he really think about secession? You can answer that question after he gives his talk. In 1990, he and Justice Dooley went around the state to seven different towns, including one of their public appearances. I think it was in this room, was it? With Howard Dean presiding. There's a great video of this that's still around. Debating the pros and cons of secession, Frank took the pro side and the justice took the negative. And then they took a vote in all seven of these towns, and all seven towns voted to secede. This is back in 1990. Frank is also a serious scholar, and he recently published his life's work, three decades in the making, Real Democracy, which is available at Bear Pond, as well as several of his books on town meetings and secession and other topics, and I recommend those highly to you. He is also a member of the Second Vermont Republic. It gives me great pleasure to welcome Professor Frank Brown from the University of Vermont Political Science Department.
The one thing I wanted to know, my favorite quote about Ethan Allen, and Kevin, maybe you can help me on this. There's a lot of myth about how he died. And my brother tells me, who's an expert on Fanny Allen, that it's recorded that as he lay in his house for a day or so close to death, his wife came up to him at some moment and she said, "Ethan, the angels are waiting for you." And he snapped back at her, "Let them wait." No, I don't know. The other thing is, thank you very much, Tom. I think I do know Ethan Allen, and I think he was a patriot to Vermont, and not just because of his holdings. And I don't think the traitor part of him is true. I mean, he did negotiate with Canada for admission to Canada as a province, but remember, there were 5,000 redcoats up there waiting to descend on the colonies, and that negotiation called the Haldimand Negotiations, led a lot by Ira Allen, actually held that army in abeyance. We don't know, you're right, Tom, whether they were doing it to get into Canada or to just to snooker him. But how can we call Allen a traitor? A traitor against whom? We weren't an American state. We'd already fought our ass off to free the colonies from the British, and they didn't seem very sympathetic to us afterward. So why shouldn't we join Canada? We're a free and independent nation. We're traitors to anybody. On that score, if I may, Tom. No, it's your show, Tom. And it's a good one. If I may, we're having a debate. John Dooley now, who shares almost no politics with me, but he and I have teamed up to now debate together against two eminent historians. You may have seen it on Channel 3 the other night, and it's in the state newspapers, to demand that New York pay us back the $30,000 ransom. It was extortion, blackmail, pure and simple. We couldn't join the union until we paid back the $30,000. That they claim, erroneously, of course, that we owed them for these bogus land grants. After we had driven the British out of their fort in Ticonderoga, where the hell were they at that time? They're down in Albany counting their money. That's where they were. And so they owe us $30,000. And this is hard to believe. The current value, the COL of $30,000, based on the cost of living index, is $800 million. It gets better. It gets better. The $30,000 based on a reasonable rate of expectation, given the stock market's record over the last 80 years, and then cutting it downward just to be conservative, is that New York now owes us $2.5 billion. That from Tom Wolf, an economist at the University of Vermont. That will completely fund all Vermont taxes for 2 years. So if Kirkpatrick's sale is here yet, you still live in New York, Patrick? Get out your wallet, baby. That's right. You're going to pay. I should say, too, that if I were to recommend one book that ought to be the Bible of not only anybody that loves Vermont and Vermont's politics, but of secession, because I think it's the theoretical basis of all secessionist movement, it's Kirkpatrick Sale's Human Scale, which was not only a courageous but a profoundly thorough and original first academic attempt to bring together the findings of the benefits of smallness. And I read that early on in my career at the suggestion of John McLowery. And you changed my life. Well, you didn't change it, but you gave me some credibility. And I thank you for that, Kirkpatrick. All right. Let us begin with a poet, songwriter, folk singer, Judy Collins, who wrote and sang in the 1970s the following lyrics I was reminded of on my drive over here this morning. She writes and she sings, "Across the morning sky, all the birds are leaving. Oh, how shall we know? Oh, how do they know it's time for them to go? Across the morning sky, we'll still be dreaming. Before the winter's fire, we'll still be dreaming. I do not fear the time. I do not fear the time." And I think in that love song are the themes that I want to talk about today. And isn't it great? We had this incredible fall. The leaves were about to go peak. the Flatlanders were poised at our doorstep, ready to come up and go, ooh, and on. Look at that cute Ramona, and see him. And aren't those leaves beautiful? And God, thank you, sent 3 weeks of cold, miserable rain. And for that is a profound lesson for us. We are not in charge of this place. Ethan Allen didn't think it was God. He thought it was nature. But whoever it is, we're not in charge. And we need that slap alongside of the head now and then to lessen our arrogance a little bit about how we live. And I'll get to that in just a moment. My wife at this moment is cuddled in our bed on Big Hollow Road in Starkesboro, facing her third day without heat or electricity. And that's good for her. Now, my themes today are then time, love, simplicity or smallness, and courage. Because I think you see all those things in that love song. That we have the courage to take solace in little things like sitting before the morning fire. And soon, isn't it true, the tourists will go home. The final golden needles of the tamaracks will fall into the forest floor. As Howard Mosier writes in Alabama Jones, the hills will grow gray, then white. And we Vermonters will still be here before our morning fires. And we do not fear the time. All right, time. I hope that this movement, of which I am a member, is ready to face the fullness of time. And like all people that speak to a group like this, I think we do have to get our credentials straight. And Kevin, I did not know you were born in New York, and I want to give you my condolences. I know, I'm about to say that. And I expect you to share these condolences with me, for I indeed am not a real Vermonter myself, even though Bill Mayers and I wrote that book, Real Vermonters Don't Milk Goat. I share the indignity of having been born in New Hampshire. I was, however, conceived in Vermont. And I was brought to term here, and according to Roe versus Wade, I quickened in Vermont. So, in the womb, and so I was a person, and my mother went across the river to West Stuartstown, New Hampshire. So if you know this region, that's right across the river from Canaan, which is the most northeastern town in the northeastern kingdom of Vermont. I base my credentials on that. I also stand before you as the only full professor at a major American university that was denied admission as a freshman. When I applied to be a freshman at UVM, I was turned down, straight scoop, even though I finished in the top 10 of my graduating class in high school. And I don't mean top 10%, I mean top 10. That was easy. There were only 7 in the class. And so I think my credentials, when I talk about smallness in human scale, are valid, are they not, Professor Sale? I graduated from Newbury High School. I began my secessionist passion in 1962 when a tyrannical court, an American court called the Supreme Court, handed down the decision Baker versus Carr, which completely destroyed Vermont's representational system in this very body. The convention all the conventions were based on the principle of one town, one vote. Vermont was created as a federal union of towns from the beginning. We were different. But, of course, the Supreme Court, representing a huge, diverse nation, can't pay attention to detail. It doesn't care about Vermont's history. It doesn't care that we're truly an American exception. We were an independent nation, America's first frontier. We joined as a republic. And that was sacrosanct. But they said, no, no, Newbury, Vermont, my hometown, would lose its representative, as every other town would. And my brother David and I seceded and wrote a letter to the UN and started a little country on an island on the Connecticut River between Newbury and Haverhill, New Hampshire. I've always wondered if that little letter is still down there, saying we will never, kind of Ethan Allen-ish. It was all bombastic. And then David got a date somewhere the next weekend, and that ended that. But we did try. My politics, and it's too bad, but you have to get these straight now if you're to be believed, and they reflect on, I hope, one of my more important messages today. My mother was a Roosevelt Democrat, loved Harry Truman. I was raised in that spirit. I once was asked to carry a Stevenson sign in the 1952 election around the Common in Newbury, where my mother was the only Democrat that I know of in town, filled with elephants and Republicans, and I made a promise to God that if I got back to the school safely, I would become a Republican, and I did. So my traditions are with Roosevelt and the New Deal. I became a Republican because the Democrat Party in the 1960s was the party of growth. They weren't anti-farmers, but they didn't like them much. Phil Hoff, now a friend of mine, once said, "I'm going to bring Vermont kicking and screaming into the 20th century, whether it likes it or not." They wanted the interstate highway. There was an awful lot of anti-small-town rhetoric among the Democrats. It was the Democrats in this very House that voted to repeal our bottle ban, which was the first bottle ban of the country. My first publication was a publication against the interstate highway system, said we didn't need it, we shouldn't have it. And so I looked to the Republicans after George Aiken, an agrarian populist, and I became a Republican. I was also a states' rightist, which has a lesson for us today. And now I can understand why people didn't like me very much. I'm just suggesting to you, I know what it is to be in a minority. Have you ever been a Republican in academia? You learn what a minority is pretty quick if you're a Republican political scientist. There aren't many. And those that are ostracized pretty quick. And I had to strategize my doctoral thesis committee, let me tell you, because I defended it during the Vietnam War. So I think I know what it means to be a Republican, but as you all know, being a Republican, an Aiken Republican in Vermont, is really being a decentralist communitarian. And in truth, it was the case. I mean, I was a Goldwater Republican. Why? Because Goldwater was willing to let Vermonters govern themselves as they saw fit, and I thought that was great. Now, the charge against Republicans of those days was, well, they were racist because they were willing to let the South have the same freedom, in which they would have taken that freedom, of course, and built up and preserved their white supremacist society. And now as I grow older and kinder, I understand they were right, that my position on states' rights, while passionate defense of Vermont, was probably intellectually wrong. We couldn't turn over more power to Lester Maddox in Georgia, or George Wallace in Alabama, or who is your governor? Ross Barnett in Mississippi. And then, of course, I abandoned the Republican Party in the 1980s when Ronald Reagan, with a mind-wrenching act of hypocrisy, forced Vermont to raise its drinking age, threatening to withhold our highway funds. And the great states' rightist, Ronald Reagan, when it was a moral issue like drinking, was perfectly willing to criminalize or take the criminal code that had been reserved to the states for all these years and give it to Washington, D.C. That's why if you get caught with a little grass in your barn in Vermont now, you can get 30 years, lose your car, and fine $250,000 because of Ronald Reagan. Now, Vermonters would say, look, you know, you're going to have to get rid of three of five of those plants. And here's a $500 fine. And that's why, along with George Bush II's, I don't know what. Maybe he was smoking some of the grass in the White House. But you know, when he and Ted Kennedy get together to decide to force the states to meet national standards on education, it's time to leave the Republican Party. So, but that was love. I love. So here I am. I don't have a party. I don't have a group. I guess this is as close as it comes. And I do know how to be a minority. But this is a long route. This has been 40 years, 45 years, since my first letter to the Free Press in 1960, championing Newbury's and Vermont's independence. Are you willing, Tom and I will be gone probably in 10 years, but are you willing to spend 40 years at it, being in the minority? Well, be careful here. Things change. So I think we have to be in it for the long haul. And that's my message about time. Year after year, we've got to stay before the winter's fire and keep our eye on the ball. And lots of times you're going to be politically incorrect. You'll be called a racist or other hateful names by people that think simply about things and don't understand you. It's not going to be popular. And by the way, no one has the patience today to explain it or listen to you explain it. Time. The second is love. I love my country. And my country is the United States of America. I love the flag. I love to hear America the Beautiful sung. I get teary-eyed at God Bless America. I'm glad I'll be gone when we secede. That song, Across the Morning Sky, All the Birds Are Living, is melancholy, isn't it? And I'm melancholy because my nation needs us. It needs Vermont to continue this secessionist movement. It's like leaving a family. It's almost like being tossed out. You may head down the road, but you look back over your shoulder and you're sad. And I am sad and I am melancholy because this is America has been a great nation. A great nation. I gave a speech, a short one, at the graduation at UVM 2 years ago when I was giving a teaching award, and the fellow that talked earlier was the director of the guy that made the movie about the fake war and dogs. What was the name of that? Oh, it got Academy Awards. It was a video war. What? Wag the Dog. Thank you. And here's what he said. He called all American military conflicts melodramas, silly. And he said, and he said something like, and that Normandy invasion, really derisive. And I felt like getting up and saying, you know, there was a little Jewish girl living in an apartment in the Netherlands. And she might have wished that the American Yanks had hit the beaches at Normandy maybe a little bit earlier. So Anne Frank would not be dragged out of that apartment, thrown in a gas chamber to die one of the most horrible deaths one can imagine at the hands of that son of a bitch, Adolf Hitler, who deserved what he got. And I'm against the death penalty, but I'd have blown his ass off in a minute with my .30-06 if I could have. And America rid the world of that man. I love America because in many nations of the world, certainly in Iraq, under Saddam, if we were here, we'd be taken right out there and shot. We'd be shot for what we're doing here today. Wouldn't we? So we don't want to be hypocrites. We need to love our country, and we need to leave it anyway. And we need to leave it with love and sadness and melancholy and not hate and viciousness. Third is simplicity or smallness. Just you and me before the morning fire. And that's what Vermont exudes. This is a great nation. It's not a state, it's a nation. Because we have a commonality, and that is rooted in our local governance, our town meetings. I don't know if Ian Baldwin is here today, but if it wasn't for him, we probably would never publish the Vermont papers. And I would recommend that as a scheme for maintaining our human scale politics. It's out of print, so I'm not going to make any money on it, but there it is. If we can't govern ourselves locally face to face, then we should not be a free and independent nation. And we're losing that capacity because we're losing our town meeting governments. And great story about that. We had this movement to put anti-Iraqi war movements on the agendas of town meeting warnings last year. I happen to know the person who went to the organizational meeting of that, where they giving out the resolutions and telling them how to go about the process of going to town meeting and getting it on the warning and voting it through. And she tells me that 90% of the people there had never been to a town meeting, had not the slightest clue on how to go about doing that. If you're not willing to govern yourselves in your own town, what the hell are we doing here today? Scale is critical to tolerance, to civility, and really it's what's happened to the American Republic, because it was from the wellsprings of little towns in the hills, Vermont and New England and all over the country, that came the great citizens that knew how to govern themselves because they were civil and tolerant. Look what happens when people begin to govern large institutions. Well, look at Howard Dean. You know, we could get along with Howard because we knew he was a little pretentious rooster, and give him a minute or two and he'd calm down. Now he's a first-class jackass running around the country telling, how the hell does he live with himself? You know, 50% of what he says is true, but the other 50%, but it's okay because no one's going to slap him alongside the head. What Howard needed early in life was to be raised in a small Vermont town. Remember the day he walked up to John Kerry? John Kerry wasn't there. He said, well, if John Kerry is going to say that about me, I wonder why he doesn't dare say it to my face. I don't know about you, but the school I grew up in, them's fighting words. And if I'd have said that on the schoolyard in Newbury, some big kid walked over and says, oh, yeah, and slapped me alongside the head. That would have given me a sense of tolerance, wouldn't it? Jonathan Miller, the great playwright, says that no relationship can be humane unless it's complicated and dutiful. You remember Jefferson said, those that labor in the earth are the chosen people of God. And you can't be in Vermont without laboring in the earth somehow. Well, we know farmers and those that labor in the earth are not the chosen people of God. Yet we're more apt to act that way. Why? Because of scale. Why is it that I will help somebody out of the ditch when I go home tonight if they're there? Because I'm the chosen people of God? No way. Because I'm afraid if I don't, I might see them at the store tomorrow and they'd say, why didn't you stop, Brian? And what would I say? Right? Duty, reciprocity, and complication. I work out in the gym over at UVM with a bunch of guys, and boy, do we get along well. We don't ever argue or fight, right? You see, we love one another. Are we friends? Is that a human relationship? No, because it's not complicated. All I know them at is jocks. I don't know how they'd be anywhere else, do I? There's no complication to it. And you can't have a human relationship unless you know people in a complicated way. And in a small town, you have to. In my little town of Newbury, there were two girls my age I could date, Penny Connors and Lenola Plummer. Penny was cute. She wouldn't walk across the street to say hello. That left Eleanor. Didn't like Eleanor much. I doubt she liked me too much. But we got along. We went to the prom together. We dated, and everything turned out okay. The only other, we used to play cards. You remember that when you were a kid? On a rainy day in the summer, you're 9 or 10 years old, you're playing cards on the front porch. We always needed a third guy. My brother, me, Waldo Nelson. And the third guy, I won't give you his name, cheated. Oh, some bitch cheated at cards all the time. Did we get him down to play cards with us when we needed a fourth? Sure. We said, well, he's going to cheat. Well, that's okay. We'll have to put up with it. Now, you do that for the first 18 years of life, and pretty soon you learn to suffer fools. And you learn that sometimes, guess who's the fool? You are. And you learn that people need to suffer you as well. And you get a little humility, and you lose a little arrogance, and you become more tolerant. And that's the base of Vermont politics. That's what we're all about. Civility, tolerance. And that comes from scale, and we have to keep it small. And finally, when do I end? 5 minutes? Jesus. Okay. Courage. Who is it that said, I think it was assuredness, or no, certitude is the refuge of weak hearts. Life is complicated. I think it was Lucille Ball, the great American comedian, that said, life is the art of reaching sufficient conclusions based on insufficient evidence. Not bad, huh? My co-author Bill Mayer said, life is the art of living with ambiguity. Isn't it true? Most of the time you make a decision, it's a crapshoot. You're never sure, are you? with your kids or your guys. What am I going to do? Well, you make the best decision you can based on what? Insufficient evidence. That's how the world runs. Now, that takes real courage. And again, I'm going to just pause for a personal note because I want you to believe me. As a younger man, I was a fighter. I boxed in the gloves in Connecticut, in Massachusetts, in Vermont, trained the St. Michael's boxing team. I know what it is to sit in the bottom of some gym and wait for 2 hours to go up and hope to hell you can knock someone out in 3 minutes before they knock you out. I know that kind of courage. When I spent 2 years in Montana, I rode the rodeo, I rode bulls. That's the single most dangerous sport in America. More people die or are sent to the hospital per event than any event in America. And I know what it is to get down in that chute when you're given an opportunity to go like this, in which case they'll open the gate, or you can go, not on this bull sucker. And I nodded. That doesn't take courage. Because once that gate's open, it's just hang on and pray. You don't even pray. What really takes courage is living with ambiguity, is complication, facing day after day the ambiguity of tough decisions and sticking with them. Hell, anyone can get on a bull or anyone can go into the ring. But what you have to do is face that ambiguity with love and patience over the long haul. And more than anything else, that takes guts. You know, Hemingway said that courage is the capacity to suspend the imagination. And Hemingway knew something about courage, the capacity to suspend the imagination. And when I got down on those bulls, I didn't imagine anything. And we can't, look, how many times people say to us, are you crazy? I mean, what are you going to do about this? What are you going to do about that? What if this happens? What if that happens? Jeez, God, if we listened to those people, we'd go shoot ourselves. Do we have the answers? Hell no. But we know what we're doing is right. And we start the process based on that fundamental ethical, moral, and conceptual framework. And then you let her go, baby. Open that gate. And things should work out. That's the kind of courage that we need. I see that courage violated. Last year at Middlebury, someone got up and railed against the Bush administration. We got to get out of this country. We've got to seek independence. George Bush is this, George Bush is that, and these people are liars or mean, blah, 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 blah. Well, guess what? Have you been listening to this thing that's been going on about these indictments? You think it's important? If you do, you don't belong with us. It's not important. It's nothing. It's trivial. It's media-manufactured excitement. It's male-female kind of getting to... I mean, it's chatter. It's not important. It's mega-media run by corporations that are selling you news and trying to get you interested. They're going to forget about it in a minute. They're praying to God there's indictments. Why? Because they hate Bush. They don't care about Bush. They want the excitement. What's happened to the media is the same thing that happens with any corporate-run mega organizations. It's corrupt to the core. And you should feel ashamed if you pay attention to any of this crap. You think that Kennedy could have survived today's media? You think the guy that trained an army in Central America secretly on your money, sent it to Cuba, sent it in to fight, then withdrew air support and broke his promise, lied about it all the time? Good God, we'd send Bush to... Where could we send him? No, I'm not going to ask this group. But you see, that's an indication of the disintegration of the American Republic. Every single president's second term goes down the tube. It's symptomatic of something complicated. That's what it is. And if, going back to Middlebury, I felt, but I didn't, like getting up and saying, oh, really? Well, does that mean if Hillary or John Kerry or some other liberal Democrat is elected president in 2008, we'll rejoin the Union? If you think this is symptomatic of anything that you see in current politics, then we're in intellectual trouble. It's symptomatic of a nation that's imploding on itself because of the reservoirs of citizens have dried up. That's what it's symptomatic. And that's why we need to secede. That is my final remark about courage. I hope you have courage to stay with us. I will end with, darn you for mentioning Solzhenitsyn, because this is going to sound, it's not going to sound right, but anyways. Okay, but I'm going to say it. It's in here. And I didn't know you were going to do that, Tom. Certainly, if you were to write a list of the great persons, men and women of the 20th century, Alexander Solzhenitsyn would be among them. Top 10. Here's a guy who lived for 25, 30 years in the Soviet Union with incredible courage, because he wasn't always in the gulag, but he didn't know when he was going and when he was getting out, or when he was going to be shot and when he wasn't. And that's what takes courage. You see what I mean? And he lived that way. Knock on the door at night, off you go. 3 more years in Siberia. Oh, all right, we'll let you go. Go home. 2 years later, knock on the door, off you go. This time we're going to shoot you. Well, he did that for 25 years. And he mixed cement in Siberia. I've always loved Solzhenitsyn because I used to mix cement as a kid, growing up on farms over in Orange County. I don't like to mix cement. It's cold, miserable, sticky, horrible work. Imagine doing that in Siberia when you can hear the firing squads. Down there, bang. Wonder who got it today. But that man kept a diary. By the way, when he was finally expelled from the Soviet Union and wept because he loved Russia, he loved his Russia, and he could go anywhere in the world to live, where do you suppose he came? The state of Vermont. He moved to Cavendish. He lived there for 15 years. He wrote 7 books in Cavendish. And when he was allowed back into the Soviet Union, he left Cavendish, and he went to the Cavendish town meeting to say goodbye. And here's one of the top 10 people of the 20th century. And he goes to the little town of Cavendish. And you know what's wonderful about it? Before he could speak, he asked permission. And they asked permission. The moderator said, if there's no objection, we'll now hear from Alexander Solzhenitsyn. If there's no objection? But wasn't it nice that even he had to meet that test? And his remarks are published in the Cavendish Town Report. They will make you weep. Read them sometime. But at any rate, when Solzhenitsyn, in his diary, at one point wrote the following. He said, when the whole world has been covered over with cement, a single blade of grass will appear, and it will crack the cement, and through that crack, freedom will emerge. I don't think I'm going to live to see it, but I do believe that in this room, at this time, at this place, in the brown hills of Vermont, there's been a crack in the cement, and through that crack, freedom will emerge. I thank you very much. Do we have any time for questions? We got 5 minutes. The boss says we can have 5 minutes for quick questions. If you don't ask me a question, I'm going to be upset. Kevin, embarrass me. Yes. By the way, I have too much chainsaw on this ear, so. Yeah, that was fun. By the way, I should say for John Dooley that I argued secession 6 times. He argued secession once down in Heartland, and when he argued secession, he won. So it wasn't anything to do with my debating skills. It was the case. We did the first debate in Bennington, and the New York Times was there, and I couldn't believe it because that huge area down there was packed. And, of course, you don't know how it's going to go. And after the debate, Howard would come to the front, and he'd call the question. And darn him, he put it this way: all those in favor of secession stand. See, Howard isn't used to town meeting. Now, it's one thing to go yay or raise your hand. It's another thing to stand. I'm going, oh God, I'm going to lose this. It was a terrible moment of silence. And then somebody, a good old redneck, could just see his pickup outside. He stood, and pretty soon everyone started to stand, and we won that debate big. The last one was here. They had to pipe the music, the thing in over there. Everything was filled up. CNN was here. The best line of the evening was, if I may say so, they said, well, what are you going to do? How are you going to back this up? And I said, first tank across the state line and no more Ben and Jerry's for you guys. And CNN loved that. But it was not serious. It isn't like you folks are doing. And let me just give you an example. The legislature thought it would be cute. Oh, those ornery, you know, they're going to want to debate. We're going to have a big party about our 200th anniversary in 1991 of joining the union. So what we'll do is we'll have these cute little debates, and won't it be fun? Madeline was governor then. But the trouble is, by the time the sixth town had voted, and voted overwhelmingly. By the way, the closest vote was guess where? Woodstock. They're looking at the stock market. They're going, wait a minute, we can't leave the union. Then the state began to get nervous. And there was a bill, by the way, there had been a bill introduced that year to get the legislature to vote, see, to up the ante a little, and they withdrew the bill. So they thought it was just cute and fun, and it really wasn't a movement. And I was part of trying to make that cute and fun as well, I must say. So I'd like to say it was a serious movement that began then, but it really wasn't. The thing that bothers me was one of the reasons I think for those votes was because there was another George Bush in the White House. And I just implore you not to make it that kind of a thing, because we're dead. We're dead if we do that.
What's your suggestion for the regeneration of the Vermont town meeting?
Well, I'm not going to beg that question, but I will tell you this. Susan, is she here? Susan Clark. Susan Clark is here. She's my co-author, and without her, the book would not be written. But we wrote a book last year called All Those in Favor. Isn't that a great title? All Those in Favor. Susan's idea. And it's about, 100 pages on how to save town meeting. And if you ask me that question now, I'll spend too much time answering it. We can't sell books here. I will tell you, too, it's the cheapest buy. It's, $5 or $10. We don't get any royalties. We did it gratis. And I wish everybody in Vermont had one. Anything else? Sir.
You've used the phrase decentralist communitarian. What does it mean?
Right. Well, I think Tom... referred to this. You know, we think of American politics as a long continuum, left, right, center. But actually there's been kind of weights pushing down on the edges. And some people, Carl Hesford doesn't agree with this. They think it's still linear, libertarian to socialist or something. And so we're meeting in the center. For instance, one of my closest political allies is Murray Bookchin, who's written the definitive work on anarchism in the 20th century, the Spanish anarchist. He lives over in Burlington. And he, you ought to, now, John McLaurie is a classical conservative with a big C. I've never enjoyed anything more in my life than to watch Murray Bookchin and John McLaurie go over it in the coffee house. And yet Murray, John, and I, and a bunch of other people in the 70s started the Decentralist League. And that was a movement to take power from Montpelier and Washington and put it back into the towns. Because the thing that's brought us together is fear of mega bureaucracies. Whether they're controlled, it isn't the source of the control, public or private. I mean, the argument used to be, well, Frank, I agree with you that bureaucracy is uncontrollable and vicious, but at least we, or the public sector is, but at least we vote for those people. That there's a, you know, that America really is a democracy. See? Well, come on. Remember Marx said that opium, religion was the opium of the masses. How could you get a revolution going when everyone figured they were going to heaven anyways in a few years, so why bother? Well, I think the lefties are right on this. I think the left is right, that the American national electoral process is the opium of our democracy. We're told that if you don't vote, you can't complain. Well, that's crap. So, there is, by the way, a national communitarian movement, which was maybe the source of your question. Etzioni and others have a communitarian league. But national communitarianism is an oxymoron. It's like jumbo shrimp and wild game management, military intelligence and legal ethics. It's a contradiction in terms. And the communitarian is willing to say, I'll give you a quick example. I once had 17 1987 Chevettes in my front yard in Starksboro. Why? Because I recycled them. I could change a timing gear blindfolded. And I drove the cheapest car possible. I never used new parts. I thought I was a responsible person environmentally. But guess what? They didn't look nice. The worst thing about the environmental movement is it's changed to cosmetics. So the town says, Frank, we've had a complaint. They say your cars don't look good. The state had a law. If the town wants to, it can tell you that you can have 3 unregistered vehicles in the yard. You get a 4th, and you have to apply to get a license as a junkyard owner. Now, from Montpelier, if you get the license to be a junkyard, of course, you have to act like a junkyard, which is to put a fence around it and pay a fee every year. So what am I going to do? Only one person complained. The Slevin called me up, Frank, he sounded apologetic. We've had a complaint. And because of the way we do this, and sorry, if there's a complaint, we're going to have you to get rid of your junks or register as a junkyard, right? Now, the libertarian in me was thinking indecent gesture. You see, these are my cars. I'm doing the right thing. I got grain in that one, chickens in that one, then they're useful. And that's true. And I'm not using any Detroit stuff to put them together. Damn it, and go to hell. That's the liberal in me. Liberal small L. I don't mean, you understand, classical liberal. The communitarian says, by the way, I suspect it was my wife who complained, so what am I doing? The communitarian in me said, Frank, this is your town. You're one of 700 voters. You can go to town meeting. If you go to the selectman's meeting, you're going to have a say. Your town wants you to get rid of those cars. Now, my dear, dear friend John McLaury would have said, property rights are as sacrosanct as freedom of speech or freedom of religion. I talked to John about this. I said, John, I'm going to give them up. He said, don't do it. But I did. I gave them up because I feel, as Aristotle said, that my human spirit is defined by the community in which I live. That you don't become humane until you join a society. That it isn't like the classical liberals would say that we join a society under a contract because it would be nice if we didn't have to, but since we're going to have a contract called the Constitution. The communitarian says, no, you can't be a human being until you're a part of a society. But the key is to keep that small enough so that humanity, your humaneness, is visible to you and the community. And there's lots of literature on optimal size on that.